Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between American University's Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Environment, Energy, Markets, and Finance Committee, this is the Hot Air Show, your source for debate and insights on carbon policy, politics, and markets. I'm your host, Christopher Barrett. In this show, we're going to be looking at everything EPA is up to in the regulation of greenhouse gases, how Congress and other folks are reacting, and the political environment as we venture into this next Congress. Before we get into the heat, let's go around the table and have the panelists introduce themselves.
I'm Robin Bravender. I'm an energy and environment reporter with Politico.
Bill Snipe, Senior Counsel, Center for Biological Diversity, and a practitioner in residence here at the Washington College of Law.
Jeanette Pablo, Director of Federal Affairs for PNM and Senior Climate Advisor for PNM Resources, a New Mexico headquartered utility.
And Mike Zimmer with the law firm of Thompson Hine here in Washington, D.C., and current ABA Chairman of the Energy Environment Markets and Finance Committee.
Thanks, everyone. Well, let's get started. There was a lot of debate over the implementation of EPA's Prevention of Significant Deterioration and Title V permit regimes for greenhouse gases. And on January 2nd, that initiated across the country. There was a bit of rancor, though, with our friends down in Texas. The D.C. Circuit took a look at that and came to the decision ultimately that while they needed time to consider the emergency stay, the stay ultimately wasn't granted. Robin, how did you see that play politically and in the policy circles once that decision was made? How much of the anticipation of what the D.C. Circuit was doing was felt here in D.C.?
The anticipation of what the D.C. Circuit was doing?
Well, in terms of deciding to stay or not to stay. Was it something that you saw as a hot topic in and around with a lot of folks?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the opponents of greenhouse gas regulations were really hoping that Texas would be allowed to stave off the EPA regulations. But EPA environmentalists saw that as a big victory that the rules were able to go forward and that EPA was able to take over Texas permitting.
I think a number of states were also watching that response by the court. I think it just fuels the fire and creates an environment of ripeness for congressional consideration this upcoming session of what to do with the EPA regulations and program for greenhouse gas emissions.
We know this is Bill Snipe. There are two ironies. I agree with both those comments, but there are two ironies to what occurred beyond what has already been stated. The first is that what Texas was ultimately arguing was that it, as a state, didn't want that authority. And so now the result of their action is that EPA is going to take over the permitting, at least for some period of time. So in some ways, Texas has taken power away from itself by its actions. The second interesting point, somewhat ironic, is that as far as I know, since January 2nd, not any, and certainly not many, actual construction permits have even been applied for by any industrial sources in the 50 states, or the 49 states plus Texas. So far, this is much ado about nothing. I think it is much more political theater on some level than it is really substantive concerns. That's my view.
Is it safe to sum up, Bill, that you believe Texas did this to themselves?
I think Texas did it to themselves. I think Texas was doing a little bit of the chest thumping, we're Texas. You know, Governor Perry's not known for being modest or quiet, and I think he was making a political point more than really a legal strategy.
Well, I think they were playing to their constituencies in state, certainly. I think, secondly, the interesting thing to watch in the future is Texas, I think, has been the seedbed of job creation since economic recovery in 2008. And watching the play out in terms of new permit applications, new projects, will be very interesting to support the continuation of their job leadership.
But now there's a federal implementation plan in place specifically for the greenhouse gas component of the permitting process. And it'll be interesting to see what type of interaction we get between the EPA regional folks and the folks at the folks in state in Texas as we go forth. And there's going to be a few test cases down the line. But it was interesting to see that a lot of the states out there were in support, saying that we have a smooth implementation of the process. And, you know, in remarks just prior to its implementation by Gina McCarthy, the assistant administrator, she did point out that she believed that this would implement smoothly. Is this, in your view, Robin, the end of at least procedural battles around PSD and the Title V component, at least, of this program? Are we going to see things be fought out basically on a permit-by-permit basis from here on out?
I would think so, and Bill can probably explain this better than I can, but I think most people watching this closely think a lot of those fights will wind up in courts in various states where EPA has taken over and where these permits come out. There's also the Environmental Appeals Board, I believe, in states where EPA is the permitting authority and industries are concerned that those fights will take a long time to play out. There'll also be fights here in Congress. Several Texas congressmen have also already introduced legislation to try and undo the Texas permitting plans of EPA. So.
Well, I agree with that, Rob. I'm very curious about Jeanette's opinion on this, but I did want to point out that life will go on, I think. I think what we're going to see by this whole process is that the world will not come to an end as a result of all this, which, of course, is what Texas and other states like Wyoming were threatening. The other interesting thing going on, which is very much related to all of this, is that while the greenhouse pollutant battle is going on that we have just been describing, EPA, because of requirements in the Clean Air Act, is moving ahead on pollution limits on mercury, smog, smog criteria pollutants. And so while those are our own concerns by themselves, they very frequently have ancillary benefits to dealing with greenhouse pollution. So EPA is already moving ahead on conventional pollutant regulation, which will have an impact itself on things like coal-burning power plants.
Jeanette, you work with a major utility that has to live these issues every day. And while Bill says that things aren't coming to an end, and the world hasn't come to an end now these regulations are in place, you could also accurately describe that we have kind of walked into the fog of Brigadoon here. We don't really know what BACT is. The guidance wasn't too detailed. And as Bill points out, there's a host of other conventional and toxic pollutant regulations coming down the pipe, all interwoven, hitting with different, you know, benchmarks, different time frames, different procedures and such. What's it like for the utility now to walk into the fog?
Well, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I know the audience is very technically and legally focused, but to kind of go back to the Texas scenario, I mean, what I see happening there is it's playing very directly into the thinking of the newly elected members of Congress, and it's a much bigger picture issue. It's not about necessarily greenhouse gases specifically on some levels. It's about what's the role of the federal government and what are states' rights. And you see that with the healthcare concern, you know, how they're addressing that or not failing to address it. You see it with a lot of the discussions on the Hill with regard to the budget. You're going to hear a lot about get the government out of our hair. And so it's a much bigger political implication, I think, than just, you know, the usual Texas, you know, breast thumping. The from a business perspective, well, the second thing I wanted to mention was these other EPA rules on coal ash 316B, which is the cooling tower requirement or proposed requirement, the criteria pollutants, and then the mercury and non-mercury hazardous air pollutants, you could almost say are really a proxy for greenhouse gas regulation, because there are a number of studies out there, ICF or Bernstein, PA Consulting, EPRI's probably going to come out with one, and the utility community is also supporting another study, a group of studies, I'm sure. And these studies show that because of the uncertainties for business and these regulations, the non-greenhouse gas regulations, the industry is going to probably shut down a number of coal plants. and they are going to build natural gas, because that's what the utility industry does when they don't know what to do. You build natural gas, and with natural gas prices being so low, you can't really justify anything else. So the brigadoon of EPA regulations, or, and I'm not criticizing EPA regulations, but the cascade of EPA regulations on the impact of coal plants and greenhouse gas emissions is showing coal plant shutdowns anywhere from 20 gigawatts to 100 gigawatts. I sort of go down more with the 20 gigawatts, but and a near-term reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, but not a long-term reduction of greenhouse gas emissions.
Many of these plants that are on the bubble, as folks would describe, because of the network of regulations that are pending, aren't those also plants that are fairly lightly controlled for conventional pollutants, for toxics already, and it's that initial slug of capital into get them controlled that if you look 15 or 20 years out, and how that plant would dispatch with greenhouse gas priced into the markets. Is it really that effect where those plants, I don't want to make the investment today, because even with that investment in place, they would not perform well economically in the future, and I don't want to take that chance.
Well, I think there's a couple of categories of coal plants, and the first category is the one that you're talking about, and you know, I sort of suspect that a number of environmental engineers have had them on the hit list. You know, I can't wait to get rid of that clunker, you know, for decades, thinking as soon as I have an excuse, I'm going to get rid of it. But they are cash cows.
Sure, old stoker plants and
right,
such.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and I think those are the ones you're seeing be announced, where their closures are being announced right now. And that's sort of the no-brainer crowd. The bigger concern is plants that have a scrubber but not an SCR,
mm-hmm.
You know, medium-sized plants. I mean, you get economic efficiencies when you put pollution control technology on a 500 or 1,000 megawatt plant, but 400, 200, 300, you know.
Exactly.
It's much more expensive. So if you have a scrubber but not an SCR, or you have an SCR but not a scrubber, I mean, all the studies I've seen conclude that under the, you know, the mercury and non-mercury hazardous air pollutant requirements that will come out, you will have to have both.
Yes.
To meet those technologies. Yes. So, you know, an SCR is, an almost up to $1 billion investment. And the second driver, I think, of the studies I've seen are not the current state of play with greenhouse gas regulation, but if you're going to put something in the ground for 20 or 40 years, you know, Tom Kuhn was quoted recently as saying, I think, you know, significant greenhouse gas regulation is inevitable, and thinking about a long-term investment, and is that a wise thing to do? So that crowd is where a lot of people are really concerned and about what to do. Do you put on the SCR or the scrubber, and do you have the manpower to do it? Do you have the cranes to do it? And are all these plants going to be able to put that technology on in the shoulder season, which is the spring and the fall when people don't need that power? And the answer is no.
Well, you know, the comments highlight the critical nature of short, mid, long-term investment scenarios. The industry is looking ahead on the power generation side for some degree of definition to support $1 trillion of investment that they see required over the next 10 years, and what the nature and mix of that investment must be in terms of generation, renewables, natural gas, efficiency, as well as transmission and distribution. The second, I think, important factor is that the comments illustrate the challenge of the one-size-fits-all type of strategy that I think Congress went through in conjunction with an omnibus type of strategy that is problematic in the environmental energy marketplace. We don't have one national energy environmental marketplace, but we have really half a dozen markets within the United States. And what the comments focus on show the importance of regional and state considerations in managing those issues more locally. Secondly, we have the prior experience of standard market design, transmission development and finance, the greenhouse legislation, as well as activity to bring on alternative energy under the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act that I think all illustrate that regional state-centric strategies are more likely to be viable and successful on the merits.
I think both those analyses by Mike and Jeanette are very cogent. And I want to bring it back just a half step and point out, agreeing essentially with what you just said, that the best available control technology standard, at least how what we call BACT, at least how EPA has defined it in the tailoring rule, which is now in effect, in essence, and I'm simplifying a little bit, but I think this is true, is really a conservation standard. It's nibbling around the edges. It's, hey, you know, cut this down, do this a little better. There's no radical, mandatory, huge hatchet over anyone's head at this point. And what makes that interesting then, and I'm now following up on Mike's regional-based reality motif here, is that when you talk about pollutants like mercury, when you talk about the pollutants that are part of a lower-level ozone, smog, those really do have, and we all know this, but significant public health impacts. I mean, people literally die as a result of these pollutants. So while I recognize, Jeanette, that there is this sort of proxy paranoia going on, and there might even be a kernel of truth to it, I think you've got to step back and look at, A, BACT, so far, not that big a deal. Come on. In fact, we think it's quite weak. And what EPA is doing with conventional pollutants, I think, has to be done. I mean, I don't think we're arguing otherwise, right?
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I couldn't agree with you more that even as, you know, a lot of the debate right now, especially on the Hill, is focused on the greenhouse gas, regulations and the need to roll them back. I mean, in some ways, that's just so yesterday, because EPA has, you know, in my opinion, done a very careful job with the greenhouse gas regs. And, when I look at sort of what are the utility engineers really concerned, the environmental engineers really concerned about, it is not for their existing plants the greenhouse gas regs. It is these other regulations coming out, which I failed to mention, these studies that show sort of a near-term greenhouse gas emission reduction benefit and a longer-term and we can talk about that later, the coal clean technology conundrum, but long-term, not such great impacts. The big benefit are these mercury, SO2, NOx, and, to the extent that they're the health-based standards. They are a true beneficiary. And your point about EPA is it's very unclear to, I'm not going to say the general public, but anybody outside the practitioner group, is unclear in their minds what EPA has to do because of statutory requirements, what they have to do because of court-ordered requirements, which they, yes, technically could change, but they'd have to go back to court, and what they have the discretion to do. And so to just talk in terms of EPA is doing this to us, some cases they're just doing their jobs. And really, I put it at the hands of Congress, you know, for not addressing the Clean Air Act and climate legislation in the way I think they should have.
Just a very quick political point. I'm a 20-year practicing lawyer. I need my own cheat sheet of following, you know, exactly all these different Clean Air Act requirements. And what I think the Republicans are doing politically in Congress right now is they're taking that confusion and they're demagoguing it. I mean, Senator Blunt from Missouri just this week sent a letter to the administrator of EPA complaining about an enforcement action of a Missouri plant that has significant pollution problems. And instead of addressing the actual substance of what was going on in Missouri, he all of a sudden started throwing on global warming regulation and this is cap and trade in disguise. He clearly wanted to conflate the two to have at least his constituents think this is all part of the same ball of wax. It's the EPA, as Tom DeLay said, Gestapo coming to get you. You better hide under your beds. I mean, that's what they're doing.
Well, I think that's a great point. Will the conversation continue to be about greenhouse gas regulations, not because they are an immediate concern, but because you cannot explain
mercury halves, non-mercury halves, 316B, NACs, you know,
it's challenging.
All that. I mean,
it's the most arguably right. one of the most complex statutes in all of American law, not simply environmental law. And to an environmental lawyer, you know, what Jeanette's really saying here is that, you know, in the law here, especially with greenhouse gases, there's a galaxy of space between Chevron Part 1 and Part 2 in terms of the step, a galaxy of space. And how do you explain, you know, if that galaxy is as, unfathomable and full of dark matter to us attorneys, what is it to the layman in terms of looking at this? I mean, and to your point, Bill, conflating cap and trade and greenhouse gas issues, it's become the latest best brand to attack anything that could be viewed as big government and so on. It's amazing how a lot of the same voices that viewed these things as cooperative federalism a few years ago is now looking at as federal tyranny. And at least from my perspective, I haven't seen an EPA black helicopter come out of the sky just yet, although the inspection teams can roll up pretty quick and can make you nervous. But with all of this going on, we saw the National Electricity Reliability Council, you know, state that the cooling water intake and the MAC standard and the transport rule and so on, even without greenhouse gases, was going to have a significant impact on what the profile of our fleet looks like, in particular those older, less controlled plants coming out. There has been calls recently, though, highlighted by the study that NERC does, the study that's happening right now at EPA and other places to model, including different greenhouse gas regimes, there have been some folks calling that EPA has an opportunity here to adopt a more unified schedule for regulations in this rank, to put forth more certainty to business. Mike, is that something that can happen, in your view, statutorily, given the different laws and authorities that are in place here? And then when you answer that, Robin, is that something that you think could happen politically?
What we're managing is the need for leadership. And to achieve that type of standardization, to integrate these various statutory schemes, will require the exercise, ultimately, of that leadership by Congress. You know, we focused on the political ramifications of their failures to address these issues, but we also live, aside from the laws of men and women, the laws of economics and under the laws of physics. In managing our energy, environmental, our power requirements. So the Congress is confronting the reality that EPA, as noted, is responding to court orders. They are doing their job being imposed by the judiciary. The economics is creating choices in terms of ultimately the merit order of dispatch of different plants under standards of our regional transmission and independent system operators. Independently, we're managing the needs for reliability to keep the lights on, as well as new requirements under EPAC. We're confronting also the need to really modernize our fleet or system. We're facing 21st century competitive issues, and we don't have a fleet that is modern to address those needs, as well as bring on the alternatives to add to the portfolio, those being the valuable contributions of diversifying the portfolio into renewables and energy efficiency, exploring the maturity of next phase nuclear alternatives, to have the industry basically poised with certainty to attract capital to make the long-term investment decisions here, to avoid ultimately capital and regulatory obsolescence. Right now, the whole system is set in place, as Jim Rogers has noted, to turn on a 3-, 4-, 6-year evaluation horizon. That limits the economic and scientific choices you can make on these types of issues that must be managed in the mid to long term for the benefit of our constituents.
So what I'm hearing from you, Mike, is that because we have so many multiple regulatory tracks going at once, being driven at different momentums by either consent decrees, judicial orders, and so on, that you'd need to have Congress step in and act and really look at a comprehensive energy policy, environmental policy scheme. Now, folks like myself who have been watching this for a good bit of time, you know, might say that, you know what, that's just pie in the sky, that Congress would do something like that. And in fact, recently we heard reports, Robin, that CARPER's three pollutant effort, which, you know, has been evergreen for decades now, it seems, is dead on arrival. Is there, in your mind, any chance that the type of unified regulatory fix could be available in this Congress, or are we just too close to the next election? Are we too partisan at this point?
I think most people would tell you that Congress is too polarized. This Congress is far too polarized on these issues to get anything done. Senator CARPER obviously has said he would always like to do his three pollutant bill. There have been some suggestions that, you know, maybe even a four pollutant bill, but given the state of Congress right now, that seems unlikely. The Republicans in the House have said there will be no big bills. Fred Upton, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, has said absolutely no big bills. And EPA regulations of any sort have been so demonized in the House that seems very unlikely in the next 2 years.
Larry Savito, political scientist over at the University of Virginia, said in maybe October that this incoming Congress is likely to be the least productive Congress in the history of that institution, and I think that he's probably dead on with that. In terms of enacting major legislation, they will achieve a number of things, but not in terms of enacting legislation. I completely agree with you. It's not only too polarized, but you have so many new people who don't have any experience, new staff and new members on in both chambers who don't have any experience, and you know. Some of us have our cheat sheets in front of us on the Clean Air Act, you know, these people have, you know, just discovered the Clean Air Act from a professional perspective, and to expect massive changes is just not in the cards. Now, this Congress could be sort of a tee-up, you know, all of our educational efforts to get them in the right place or, you know, explain the Clean Air Act. I mean, that's where we're going to be spending our time. But I have not seen a single proposal to align EPA regulations of coal plants that would not require, significant congressional action.
And I think in response to that, what we've almost seen in terms of long-term future planning in this area, a dual perspective kind of arise, that being what can we do to maintain these important values in the period of 2010 to 2025, and then what will be necessary to position ourselves in the period of 2025 and thereafter in terms of longer-term investment, the advent of innovation, new technology, as well as the critical nature of attracting capital to get this job done.
I'd like to make a point. Again, I agree with all of this, but my take is that it's the concept, it swirls around the concept of the law of unintended consequences. And I think one of the reasons why, in fact, maybe the reason why cap and trade died last year, or last Congress, and why even not the House Republicans themselves, but the Tea Party movement itself, Koch brothers notwithstanding, the reason why those movements have legs is because I think the American people are small-c conservatives. And I don't mean that in the political Bill Riley, Rush Limbaugh sense. I mean that in the sense that I believe I am, cautious people. You don't want to do radically new big things. You want to take incremental steps on this. And I think, and despite what Mike says about that we do need this big picture thinking and movement, unfortunately we're not China. Fortunately we're not China. Wow, I'll be ripped to shreds for that. Fortunately we're not China. Where we actually do have a democratic system, the reality is the Clean Air Act is something we've had for 40 years. People know how it works. A lot of professionals have used it. And so I think for the next 2, 3, 4 years, I actually think it is a positive development that we finally get rid of these old clunkers that you've talked about, Jeanette, that we begin the transition to incentivize renewable energy forms. And while I would like to envision a brave new world, a brand new day, the way Mike envisions, I think for the reasons Robin has stated, the only chance we have are to take these incremental, hopefully larger steps over the next couple of years.
I do want to get back to some Clean Air Act specifics on what EPA is up to, but let me ask this question to the panel. In this discussion about the mood of the country following the tragedy in Tucson, Are we past the days where we're going to see pieces of environmental and energy legislation shot at in political ads?
No, I think, unfortunately, and I hope that I am wrong, I think the Tucson tragedy, at least for the 535 members of Congress, will seem like ancient history in a year. And I do not see at least the House Republicans, the Cook-led House Republican Tea Party bandwagon, I do not see them backing off their rhetoric. I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I recently heard this week a new chairman of one of the committees say, you know, I'm not supposed to use words like, you know, in my vocabulary, like shoot and all that stuff, you know, because of that thing that happened in Arizona. So I would agree with you. I do want to take issue with the assumption that we've had it is a fact we've had the Clean Air Act around for decades, and there is some predictability to the imminence of rulemakings, like the NAAQS every 5 years, et cetera. But I would like to take issue with the fact that that translates to people responsible for compliance with a predictable path. So, for example, in my own company, we've had a couple of rules impacting us recently, and we did not know until they came out and whether we would be required to put an SCR at about $800 million on our plant or an SNCR at about $80 million on our plant. And that's a big difference, and it's a huge uncertainty. So, you know, when I've talked to some environmentalists, they're like, what are you complaining about? You've known this was coming for years, and even the so-called train wreck slide in the early iterations a couple months ago, only they had 2003 on it. So, yes, there are certain predictable aspects of it, but in terms of, from a practical compliance perspective, you haven't had enough certainty to make a plan.
I respect that, and I guess my only pushback on that is, given the nature of the problems, and particularly from my vantage point, global warming, I know there are associated problems, there's going to be change no matter what. So all I'm saying is, in this imbroglio of massive change, it seems to me as a small-c conservative that the Clean Air Act is the most well-understood tool that we have, because any other tool is going to be new and scary anyway if it's actually going to be effective. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure what the alternative is.
Right. I take your point, and it's a good one. And I actually agree that, you know, the American people are small-c conservative in terms of we're all just running around trying to get our coffee made in the morning and the kids out to school and spending hours reading, you know, the Clean Air Act or, you know, 1,000-page pieces of legislation. Only people who get, you know, who have a boss who actually demands that you do that or get paid big bucks to do it are spending their time there. And when I'm at home, I don't really want to pay attention to it, and I know my neighbors don't either. So I agree with you on that.
Well, it's interesting. As a friend of mine put it, if we could take some of the folks in the environmental community and sit them down and force them to join the integrated resource planning teams of utilities, to go through that process in front of a PUC, not just intervening, but go through the actual resource selection process, look at the impact on rates, look at the host of issues that utilities care about, that we might have a different perspective on the timing and the punctuation of all of this. It was interesting to point out that the utility industry in particular, Edison Electrical Institute, the theme has been certainty. Certainty for our capital stock outlays, certainty for an industry that needs to sink steel in the ground and usually lives there for, you know, at least 40 years plus and such. Robin, Politico scooped just yesterday a number of meetings that the GOP staff on the Energy Commerce Committee on the House side was having with folks in industry, and notably EEI wasn't invited because, quote unquote, they supported a cap and trade system and such. I find it fascinating that, you know, every time power shifts, there's always a story with the other party saying, oh, well, you're off meeting with, you know, NRDC and the green groups and so on and creating this shadow system of legislative drafting and such. How could you possibly do that? And then it flips the other way, and, well, you're meeting with industry associations and creating that cycle seems to be going on and on and on. Do you see the coalitions that were pulled together at the end of the last Congress, before Graham pulled out of the Senate coalition, around Carrie Lieberman and such, do you see that those coalitions made up of U.S. Climate Action Partnership, EEI, and even folks like API saying that we're not going to pull out the pull out the swords and come rush you, by doing this, basically saying that for the first time we're just not going to attack, but we're also not going to support, which was a gain. Are those coalitions done for in this new Congress? What relevancy do they have? Obviously, Edison and the long-established ones will continue, but the other multi-industry coalitions, like USCAP and so on, are they going to continue to have relevancy in this new Congress, or are we seeing folks kind of break down to their core constituents once again?
My sense is that all bets are off now that the cap and trade bill has died. It looks like a lot of industry groups are trying to get as much preemption of EPA as they can, and that's what that meeting was about, was House and Senate Republicans trying to get them on board with pushing for as much EPA preemption as they possibly can, and that seems to be what their starting point will be in this Congress. Senator Barrasso will be starting out with a full EPA and federal Greenhouse Gas Authority preemption bill likely next week. It sounds like there'll be something similar in the House, and it sounds like many industry groups are completely on board with getting as much preemption as they possibly can for now.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they can get something out of Congress, let alone avoid a veto on the president's desk on this. And there's some interesting dynamics that I'd like to get into in a little bit about the proposal around a clean energy standard and the kind of trade of offering a pause on EPA's activities on the greenhouse gas regulatory front.
Can I just point out how cynical industry's strategy is here, though? It may be a good strategy, but it's incredibly cynical, which is they know that if this were a standalone bill, this preemption idea, the president would clearly veto it. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But what's really going on, and again, I'm not sure the American public gets this, I guess this is my job to get the word out, is that their goal is to stick it onto another bill, maybe a government shutdown, maybe a funding of unemployment, whatever the important thing, so that Obama can't veto it. And the fact that that's the game that we're playing on something like global warming, to me, is cynical.
Well, I want to take issue with that because, first of all, you're painting the industry with a very broad brush. And are you talking about API, EEI, who are you really talking about here?
I'll say API in the chamber, not you, Jeanette. How's
okay,
that?
Because, we're founding members of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, and I think there's a lot of concern within industry about what is the step forward and from a productive perspective. With Congress, standalone bills don't exist anymore, and I don't really know how that's going to play out, but I'm not clear that it's going to really help anybody.
Every bill is Christmas time in Congress.
Every bill is Christmas time. Yeah. And then in terms of coalitions, if you think about USCAP when they were created in 2006, the climate was a little different because there was some indication that more Republicans would be supportive, starting with Senator Domenici for a time, of climate legislation. There was about 2 years of sort of behind-the-scenes conversations on what would really work, because it does take that amount of time, and this is that time now. So these trade associations have a very diverted, a number of factions within their membership that's going to keep them from being as effective for each individual faction as that faction would like. And so I see after, 6 months of recovering from, last year, some possibility of coalition development for a clean energy standard, I think.
Well, I would agree with all the comments that have preceded me. Building on Jeanette's last point, I'd observe in parallel track, I envision or forecast an increase in enforcement action and activity by EPA over the next 2 to 3 year period of time. I also see increased reliance on prior coalition members of the court and litigation process, too, either on defense or offense, in managing, positioning, framing these issues in a different manner. I'd also observe, interestingly, looking ahead, what elements of the prior coalitions were missing that might be the critical trading blocks for the future to add to the mix. As Robin noted, all bets are off and we're really reforming, looking ahead to the future. And I'd observe an increased role for natural gas, which was skipped over in the House, started to appear as a more relevant consideration on a bridge transition basis in the Senate. I think a need to increase the role of efficiency, and those that support the efficiency mantra as a business, as a manufacturing, as a public policy tool to change this market and environment for the long term. I also saw missing, I think, active, important state engagement or involvement that needs to be integrated at the table to build basically new partnerships, maybe, as Chris has noted, a more integrated constituency to ultimately get the type of leadership and get the type of standard and get the type of job done we need for the well-being of the country moving forward.
Now, Mike, you said something that was interesting. You said that you expect an increase in EPA enforcement actions. That's something that I think a lot of us could see happening with conventional pollutants, with toxics, through the transport rule, the mercury MACT rule, and so on coming. However, is that something that you really see happening when it comes to the permitting programs in place now for greenhouse gases with kind of let a thousand flowers bloom approach? We have, as you pointed out, different energy resource bases across the country, different energy markets and such, different attitudes and interpretations of really how one should go through establishing and looking at the scope and the depth of what is best available control technology for greenhouse gases. With all those different approaches, and with the prospect that you could well have the Environmental Appeals Board and ultimately the federal circuits putting bookends on a huge approach of where greenhouse gases could be, do you really see EPA enforcing heavily on the permit front for greenhouse gases, other than just did you follow the steps?
I think it'll be a multitude of considerations, both ultimately under the greenhouse gas requirements. I think we've also noted the ancillary or indirect consequences of enforcement in other areas, whether they be mercury, whether they be ozone, smog, particulate requirements going forward. I think thirdly, what you're going to see is bringing these tools out that have somewhat been dormant perhaps the past 2 years while we focused on this as a policy matter to get people's attention. Under the prior administration and the Clinton administration, enforcement was a high priority. It was very successful. Under the leadership of the prior administrator, 85-90% of those cases were ultimately won by the EPA. So the smart people, the people that are building a country for the future, know that this is really just an interim measure, a short-term step, and that to really position the country for the long term, we need to get on with business to modernize our country and show that the country's open for business. Again, that we're promoting advanced manufacturing and growth for the well-being of various constituencies and stakeholders in the country. The maintenance of this kind of logjam and the maintenance of this type of political gaming is not a viable long-term strategy for anyone, but instead it appears in the short term an opportunity to force shifts in the composition of committee structure, constituents in the Congress, to position perhaps the Congress to act in a more definitive manner starting in 2013.
Well, EPA, it seems, agrees with you in that at least the PSC and the Title V programs are a short-term first step to this. Bill, July 26th this year, that's when by a settlement agreement EPA will roll out their new source performance standards for greenhouse gases. Could happen a number of different ways. There's a lot of different routes to it. Sector source specificity, different types of categorical combinations. We could see trading. We could see allowing state programs like what's going on in the northeastern states with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or out west with the Western Climate Initiative and California's efforts under AB 32, being allowed to become NSPS, to form that floor and such. What if you had to guess right now what you're going to see on July 26, 2011, what would it be?
I actually have no idea. I mean, I really don't. And I'm not sure anyone has an idea. Perhaps Gina does, McCarthy, in the back of her mind, but that is very clearly, I had NSPS written here on my today's cheat sheet. I don't know. I mean, what I'd like to see is some articulation in the NSPS process of what the ultimate goal is here. And this gets to our ambient air quality petition, which mm-hmm. I will bring up. I know you wanted me to raise that. And
any response yet?
No response yet. No one's holding their breath or yet losing sleep about it. But I know this sounds a little bit somewhat stereotypical that I would say this, but I think I need to emphasize. I mean, just within the last week scientifically, the Arctic, even in the winter, is now melting faster than scientists predicted. Greenland, which of course is land-based, is melting. Its glaciers are melting quicker than scientists thought, which of course leads to sea level rise. I mean, the impacts of global warming are happening literally right now. And so our point of view with regard to both the national performance standards as well as ambient air quality standards, which for other pollutants have a synergy to them, they're interrelated under the Clean Air Act, is to ask the question, what does the best available science say we need to do to avert human catastrophe as a result of global warming? And we may not like that answer. We may use the Clean Air Act's flexibility to say, well, that's not really perhaps realistic yet. But what's astounding to me is that we haven't even asked the question, that we continue to talk about 450, 550 parts per million of carbon dioxide, somewhat completely oblivious that the best available science says that's far too high and far too high a risk. So that's the context by which we're looking at it. But as the specifics go in July, I really don't have a clue.
The little C conservatives in America, as you've termed it, Bill, they're cautious. Wouldn't the precautionary principle kick in here? Or is it running up against what has demonstrably been an effective argument, that this is something that in economic times would cost the country, and because other folks haven't stepped up to the plate, the chicken and the egg argument about global leadership with the BRIC nations and so on in the United States, but being able to tell the average person, well, the Chinese aren't putting anything in place here, let's go forward. Now, I'll point out, though, that of late, the Chinese have stepped up with a number of initiatives aggressively driving forward on this, but they're still, you know, kicking out a subcritical coal-fired, pulverized bed plant, still readily, even under the new policies. So is that sense of precautionary principle, caution of the little C conservative, how is that going to be able to engage with such a global issue where the effects are a world away, a pole away up in the Arctic or in Greenland and such, and some of the effects here in the United States are going to be, adaptation is going to be a mixed bag. There are going to be some places that actually enjoy the way they change.
I think, taking Bill's point, Chris, I think the response has been the escalation of the role of adaptation in recognition of the global phenomenon that Bill has very aptly summarized. I think the other interesting question is we've only had one study of global national import regarding the consequences of maintaining the status quo. All of the studies that focus on change and the economic consequences of projections of various change scenarios. But the only study that's been done in terms of maintenance of the status quo is the Stern Review. Mm-hmm. That has had a lot of deficiencies that have properly been noted. But the intriguing question is, both nationwide as well as regional or even globally, no one has gone back to the drawing board to do an update or more granular, more effective, detailed review of what the maintenance of the status quo yields. Because I think our friends in the insurance industry, our friends on Wall Street, our friends in the electric utility sector, as well as those that rely upon water is a key predicate for their business in the beverage industry, certainly are starting to draw or connect those dots looking ahead to the future, and that type of work might yield a more informed debate and ultimately a more higher qualitative decision.
I wouldn't have worded it exactly like that myself, but I essentially agree. And what's interesting about your point is that this idea of economic injury, economic damages by regulation. I mean, it really is so demagogic. And, I mean, let's look at the subsidies that go into the very industries that are now crying foul. I mean, the nuclear industry, the coal industry with CCS, I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars. So I think a much more honest economic discussion in the type of way that Mike is talking about would reveal that all this EPA hand-wringing is really small potatoes compared to the economic questions that need to be discussed right now. That's my view.
Jeanette, this discussion segment started about asking what would we expect in July from NSPS. From your perspective and from industry's perspective, you know, for that which is supposed to set the regulatory floor for greenhouse gas controls across the country, what do you anticipate seeing?
Yeah, I have the same answer as you did. I have no idea. I don't mean to be cynical, but I've rarely found that what you need, because you desperately need something, that's actually what you get out of Congress or the regulatory agencies. EPA is required to do certain things. They, you know, we've talked about how they actually have limited discretion in certain areas, but they are in some ways fighting the battle of their lives this year. And they've exhibited, to the extent that they've had the discretion to do, a very, I would say, prudent, careful, step-by-step pathway, because a lot of them actually see the big picture and are not going to sacrifice, today's battle for tomorrow's war, which I think is the perspective of many. You know, people go into EPA, go into the Fed maybe because you love law, but you go into EPA because you want to save the environment. It's a unique institution in the federal family, I think, in that way. So I would expect a prudent-based proposal or, result rather than doing what we need. And, frankly, once you use the word adaptation, you're really talking about an epitaph for what we really need. I mean, it is a concession right there on the table.
It raises all the what I've been calling the Venetian process questions. For those of you who aren't familiar, Venice is raising seawalls, massive seawalls. The Association of low-lying states and so on, OASIS and such, they feel it coming. They have felt the sea level rise. Is it going to need something like that to get us moving on this? That's a big question. And it's interesting that, having folks here around the table from industry and having folks from the environmental group, and no one is really quite sure what it's going to look like, let alone if the much lauded efforts on the state and regional levels are going to be allowed to participate, or is going to be one other layer of federalism in this Gordian's knot of cooperative federalism. We shall see. It's an interesting subject that we probably won't know till July, it sounds like.
That's right. Well, I see that time is running short, and Chris, I just want to make the final comment, unless someone says something I really disagree with, but this has been a good discussion. My last obvious comment to conclude from my vantage point is, my prediction is at least the House is going to overreach. Clearly going to overreach. And I think then the question is, what is left in the rubble? Will the administration take that vacuum and show leadership? Will Harry Reid make Fred Upton look foolish? Or will this type of demagoguery continue? I think that is really what the next 2 years is about. I agree with Mike. I think we all agree that really no radical changes are coming down the pike. We're going to be seeing some incremental steps, the architecture put in place. And whether Congress deep sixes that is, I think, the ultimate question in the next 2 years.
Well, I would conclude, Bill, I agree, but getting back to the bigger picture, life will move in parallel track outside of the Beltway. And what are the elements of those parallel tracks? The utility industry needs to move forward in defined planning, integrated resource planning, to build the kind of modern system we need to at least meet the challenges to 2025. We're going to see incremental growth in establishing the role of natural gas and the new technology improvements with shale gas. Thirdly, our corporations are providing leadership in terms of more integration of sustainability as a governance, as a board level matter on a going forward basis. Fourth, from a technology development perspective, we're going to see the increasing fabric of reverse innovation, and basically a lot of our technology companies leading through innovation developed in India, developed in China, and then licensing back ultimately that technology into the United States going forward. They are not standing still waiting the outcome of this debate. And finally, leadership is starting to appear in the military defense sector as they look at the important role of these issues in managing their mission and responsibilities. And history has shown that the civilian sector ultimately is the beneficiary of that leadership for the future.
Jeanette, utilities have an obligation to serve load fundamentally, reliably, so that the lights come on and modern society, as we know it, goes on. When we're wrapping up this discussion, do you see this regulatory fog that we've talked about clearing somewhat, or are utilities going to have to kind of march through it, march through every integrated resource planning process and so on, taking a constant step of the status of disruptive technology in the energy sector? Are we in a place where we're going to continue in that fog and just kind of be poked along direct, you know, here and there as we go, or do you see this coming and clearing, or is that a talk for the next election?
Well, I think that the House pathway, whether it's successful or not, will be indicated by what happens in 2012. And unfortunately for the people at this table, we're not looking to the next 2 years like our politicians are. We're looking to the next 40 years. And we risk, given the current pathway, a terrible scenario where jobs are delayed because of uncertainty for business. We're going to end up buying all of our clean energy technology from China. Our current banker, if you read the WikiLeaks, you know, Hillary Clinton quote. And it's not the kind of scenario that the average American, you know, consumer really wants to see, but they don't want to see their electric bill go up 30% either.
Robin, any last words about what you're going to see happening from the impact of when EPA rolls out in July, from this fog in Congress? It sounds like from your earlier comments that we're simply destined for gridlock.
Yeah, we could have a fight pretty quickly in Congress on this. I mean, opponents of EPA regulations are looking at the CR or possibly the debt ceiling, which could come early this year. So we might see that play out quickly. Many people think there's a good chance the Senate will pass something to stop some of these EPA regulations, not just on climate, but on conventional air pollutants as well. And then in terms of July, I think it's unclear what we're going to see. EPA made it clear that it won't be a cap and trade program. I know there was some possibility that they were considering that, but they've done everything they can to emphasize that it will be modest, but I don't think that'll stop the pushback coming from people in Congress and industry groups.
Well, to wrap up the show with a note on common ties, both the environmental community and the utility industry both operate with a mind towards the next generation. And so therefore, I think it's safe to say that everybody involved in energy are states folks, statesmen and stateswomen. And part of the challenge that we have in the industry is dealing with politicians who have their eye on the next election, not the next generation. And that generational perspective is really a unique combination that you have between industry and advocacy, because other types of industries don't have that same type of tenure in presence in our society. So maybe that's a common tie that we could all build on going ahead on this. On behalf of everyone involved in bringing you the Hot Air Show, thanks for listening. Looking forward to having you join us next time in the heat.